Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Mira Evnen, and I haven't had a guest roll in with such swagger in a while, carrying, what, a Campari and soda?
Yeah.
It's one, it, well, one of those kind of days?
Yeah, I think so. I want the sun to come out, and the car ride over here wasn't nice to me,
yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's nearing. Yeah. And, you know, for a West Coast Oakland lady, the pastoral sun always seems to shine on the East Bay.
Well, yeah, well, sort of. I mean, these great days are familiar to me, and I kind of have a love-hate relationship with them.
So. Yeah. Well, let's dispel that, you know, the land of Chez Panisse and Alice Waters is just the most beautiful bounty you've ever seen. Is it true, or is it untrue?
Oh, it's true.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I have very sweet memories of it growing up. I mean, I worked there for a short time. I grew up going there, eating across the street at the Cheese Board. I mean, it's so much part of my youth that I think back of it on it so sweetly, but it is beautiful. Every single time I go back, it's just incredible.
Yeah, I mean, you literally grew up on the UC Berkeley campus.
Yeah, I was born on the UC.
Oh, really?
Student housing. My parents were there. My father was doing his PhD. I was literally born on the zip code of UC Berkeley campus.
So, do you remember what the food temperament was like then? I mean, you have a father who's English, mother who's Israeli, so you already have that multiculturalism. But I feel like there was so much happening in Berkeley at that time.
Yeah.
Was it just bred into you?
It was. And it took me leaving, I think, to come to the East Coast to kind of recognize that. I had traveled so much growing up that it just... you know, my travels and where I grew up and how we ate in the house was just totally normal to me. And it was, I took it very much for granted. And I think it's been in the last decade, you know, the decade that I've lived on this East Coast, or more, actually. I've come to understand it better.
Sushi. Let's use that as an example, because you have such a wonderful story about kind of your introduction to sushi was at a very, very young age, almost prenatal.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, my mom had discovered it when she was pregnant with me, which, you know.
Antithetical to what they say today.
Exactly, but who cares? We would go on vacation. I think early on there's a picture of me in Hawaii, like scarfing down brown rice and raw tuna, and I have a haircut like my two older brothers, and because that was just easier for my mom. And I don't know, it's one of my favorite foods. There was a short time in college that I think I overdid it with the sushi, and I was like, I can't eat anymore. But then you have really good sushi again, and it's okay.
But this was like a request at birthday parties when you were very, very young. You preferred sushi over chocolate cake.
Yeah, my mom brought out that cake, and I just looked at her, and I said, more sushi?
is it that aspect of food or home cooking that's been kind of the center point of how you interact with cuisine?
I think it's more of the home cooking and breaking bread with people. I mean, I do love going out to eat, and I love experiencing food cooked by others and food from around the world. But I think for me, ultimately, it's like going to somebody's home, sitting at a table with them and eating what they like to eat, which is the most exciting for me.
You know, we're really going through your whole life now, because let's talk about elementary school, because an extension of eating at home is often found in kids' lunches.
Yeah.
And I remember kind of being one of those boring ones, because I think I ate nothing but tomato and mayonnaise sandwiches for a good like 3-4 years. But you can't, it's not a currency. You can't trade that at the schoolyard.
Oh, I'd trade for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what did you have and what did you trade for then?
There was just, I mean, there was the, like, Chinese food leftovers, which I always, I would eat, like, strategically to save some for the next day. And if it survived my brother's pillaging the fridge, I would take that to school. Or, I don't know, there was, you know, I'd make myself turkey sandwiches on a bagel, which, you know, I at the time thought were bagels. And then I came to realize that they were, like, steamed buns or something like that from Noah's Bagels. But, yeah, no, it's, I think I just really early on just, you know, trading with people and tasting what they like to eat was fascinating to me.
And one day, will you recreate Diane's teriyaki drumsticks or her father's for me?
Yeah, I will try. You know, I actually think it's that teriyaki bottle that has, like, vaguely Asian, but somehow still looks, I think it's the oy vey. The oy, have you ever seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was that with the sesame seeds on it, and it was, like, deliciously burnt on pieces. And
don't get me on the parallels of Jewish and Japanese cuisine.
Oh, well, that's for another show. For another show.
But, you know, all this seems so almost curated, I said. I'd like to say, you know, your life has had these instances inflected with food in these kind of wonderful ways, from your parents' business trips to Japan and then waking up to Japanese breakfast, miso soup, rice, and sukemono. At what point did you decide that, you know, all this kind of crowdsource food knowledge was something that you wanted to kind of turn into a career?
I mean, I think I formally figured that or came to terms with it just a couple of years ago, and I'm still in that process. I mean, it's funny how if you're astute enough, you can notice, at least hindsight, you know, it's like my friend Fanny Garson just posted a photo of her from, I don't know, she must be like three or something like that. And she has like chocolate on her face and an ice cream scoop in her hand. And she's standing there kind of like a boss over these things that she now is such a boss over. So I said to her, I said, isn't it funny how like these things are so apparent at an early age? And so I think for me, I'm still kind of, it's still revealing itself to myself. If I was willing to look at it without anxiety and without, you know, the mind of an artist or whatever, I think I'd be maybe a little bit more at ease with it. But it's always revealing itself to me. So I'd say I just decided yesterday that I was gonna do it.
You know, at 13, you took a Thai cooking class. At 15, you assisted Alice Medrich. Yeah. At 16, you took a course at Cordon Bleu, I mean, in Paris. It was always a fascination, but, you know, it takes, like you said, an astute but kind of wanted soul to really say, this is me, this is who defines me.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a combination of growing up and having parents who, at the same time, were incredibly supportive about pretty much anything I wanted to do, but also had their own concerns about, you know, working really hard. And my mother always said, well, if you work in a kitchen of a restaurant, you work the life of a dog. And that might be true, but if you enjoy that, then that's what it is. And so I think it's been kind of a constant process of revealing itself to myself about it. And I still have those things where I don't know what you thought you were going to be when you grew up, but
I haven't grown up yet.
Well, that's good. Don't. I kind of still say that when I grow up, I want to be XYZ. And so it's still a process. And I think we have these ideas about, or at least I should say I have these ideas about things that I should be doing and things that I want to be doing. And then when I think about what I'm actually doing, it takes my friends like you and other people to remind me that I'm actually doing things that I love, that I'm good at, maybe I'm not so good at, but I'm interested in. And it's yeah.
I always feel like it's about what you're doing now, you know, and I could keep on listing off when in high school you worked for June Taylor, one of the most wonderful women in preserves. You know, you worked at Red Hill Dairy in San Francisco.
Redwood Hill, yeah.
At the farmer's market, yeah. Before it was in its bespoke place behind, you know, the ferry building. But it's always about the investment in the now.
Yeah.
And I've known you as a person to be, you know, completely invested in whatever you're dealing with at the moment. Nick's Tamal and Masa is kind of at the forefront of what you're doing now.
Yeah.
But as someone like you, and I consider myself in the same kind of cadre of people, being a jack of all trades or being a Renaissance person isn't always the best thing in a specialized world.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, that's, it's tricky. The irony in all that is that my background is, I was formally trained as an architect, and I worked as an architect for a short time. And I remember thinking, I want to be really good at being an architect. And the irony is, of course, like, an architect is a jack of, you know, they're a jack of all trade, master of none. Like, and where you're kind of you're very good at many different things. And so I guess I've stayed consistent in that want. And I've augmented that saying to be jack of all trade, master of some. So, you know, I think I realize that there are things that I'm always going to want to dapple in and try. But it also keeps me from doing things, you know, like the whole Nixtamal Amasa thing. I love it. But do I actually want to pursue that as like a full time for the next, you know, 2 to 5 years as a business of sorts in whatever form that comes to life in? It often stops me. So, yeah, it's a blessing and a curse. Yeah. I don't know, do you find that as well?
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes that leads to just knowing where all the best taco joints are.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is an asset in and of itself. But, you know, I'm a chip away person. I slowly, but if my work methodology was cuisine, it would be barbecue because it's very slow and low. But when it comes out, it's like exactly right and what you want. Yeah. And, you know, kind of been poured over, but I can't do something without kind of thinking about it, ruminating about it for way, way, way too long. I'm the same way with buying pants, though.
Right. So you just never, you're just pantless.
Yeah, most of the time.
He's pantless right now, yeah. Everybody. No.
They call it the Pooh Bear. but, you know, again, being fascinated by so many things, it's when do you take the risk and plunge into whatever pool that is and just say, this is who I'm going to be right now.
I wish we could take calls because I want to hear like everybody's ideas of when do you know, you know? I'm still kind of recognizing that and figuring it out.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and figure that all out for you off air and then come right back and chat some more. Cool. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. We'll be right back.
I'm Michael Harlan Turkell, host of The Food Scene and Modernist Breadcrumbs on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Bob's Red Mill to find out from Bob himself why his products taste so good. So what's the secret, Bob?
To make the best whole grain flour, we look back in time. No modern technology can match the old world engineering of a stone mill.
Wow. Bob's Red Mill is using stone mills? How old are we talking here?
Well, the stone mills are practically as old as mankind, and no matter what civilization they uncover, they find two stones that people were rubbing together to make something they could eat, whole wheat flour. But the stones that we use are quarried near Paris, France, in La Ferté, and it's the same stone material from the same quarry that the Romans used to make stone mills all over the Roman Empire, of which you can testify by looking at Pompeii. It's a quartz material. It has a uniqueness about it. It's very hard. It has a certain porosity, and they put the stones together in a unit of 20 pieces and band it so that they use only the best and sharpest parts. It's an ingenious thing. But very old. I mean, thousands of years old. So it's pretty cool.
Those sound like some really special stones. How do they work?
Stones turn either the top or the bottom stone, turning at 100 to 125 revolutions per minute, produce a lovely 3-4 up to 500 pounds, depends on how soft the grain is. The bottom stone is the bedstone, and it's also called the nether stone in the Bible. But it also now turns for some configurations.
Would you say that using stone mills lead to healthier grains?
I know they do. I can watch it. I showed you. You know it as well as I do. The grain goes in the top, goes through the stones, and it comes out. We don't lose anything, and we don't add anything.
Thanks for sharing the story of how Bob's Red Mill is using ancient technology to keep their products on the cutting edge.
Michael, we think that we can make a difference by sticking by the traditional way of stone milling whole grain, and that's what we're doing.
You can learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast. Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkill, here with Mira Ev9.
Yeah.
No, see? I said it wrong, and I'm seeing if you're going to
No, but I responded.
In the whisper. But, you know, we were talking about kind of being an undefined person in the food world, and there are a lot of these kind of, I'm going to use the word incorrectly, polymath, somebody that, you know, has the skill set and can really do everything, but doesn't do one thing. And I know you as a stylist. I know you as a flower arranger. I know you as someone who came, a handful of weeks ago and helped me package bento boxes for my sumo stew events.
It was delicious.
This engagement of doing all these things, you said, kind of stops you from doing that one thing that you want to do. What are all the things that you're doing right now? And let's vet it out for you, and we'll figure out which way you should go.
Oh, man, if I can remember everything, this is the problem. Well, currently, something that's just at the very beginning of the process is a cookbook that I'll be styling and collaborating with a couple of other really talented women. It's a Syrian cookbook, or rather a cookbook for a Syrian refugee. We just came up with the name, which is Bread and Salt Between Us. I think the subtitle is something like, I should probably know this, but, recipes from a Syrian refugee kitchen or something like that. So working on that came to me through, dear friend and colleague, Liz Clayman, who's an amazing photographer who, you know, and that came to her through someone else, and it was just kind of this Jacob's ladder of connections. And so we'll be working on that this summer. We're just at the beginning of that. So that's something I'm really looking forward to. And then there's, I don't know, what else am I working on, Michael? I don't even know.
Well, you know, it's your care and compassion to, like, this culturalism, being, like, present on what is important in this kind of global world, you know, Syrian refugees now, but you have an understanding about, you know, so many people and how their cultures affect other cultures. And I almost feel like that's where your greatest assets lay, almost as like this conduit, this mediator of sorts. Because if there's something that you're doing, and I often peruse your Instagram, I said, what the heck is that? I try to extract that and pick your brain of that.
Yeah.
Do you do that with other people? And if so, what are those things kind of at the forefront right now?
Good question. Yeah, I think I do that. Instagram's just, it's a rabbit hole. I mean, I just, it's both awesome and such a time suck. I think I'm constantly looking to understand, kind of how history has impacted our food, habits. What are the connections, like my interest in Mexican food, for example. One of my favorite things about it is finding the connections between Middle Eastern cuisine and Mexican cuisine and this idea of Moors to Mexico. So sometimes you'll see me post something and I'll hashtag it Moors to Mexico, because it's something that I'm trying to catalog for myself, because I see a potential of a project there. Another one is Immigrant Food Project, which to my delight, I've seen so many people start. I mean, when I started that, like literally the day before Trump, you know, was sworn into office, there weren't that many hashtags in it, and it's just kind of mushroomed, which is awesome. But looking at, like, you know, there are so many different cultures in New York alone, that, you know, we partake in certain foods, or the connections of similarities between certain dishes, and kind of the genesis of that I find really fascinating, and how it impacts our lives. I mean, I just think the minute, for me at least, like if I don't have something to say to somebody or I'm looking for an in to start a conversation with someone or, you know, overhear something at the supermarket about cooking, it's immediately a way to connect with somebody, because everybody, for the most part, has to eat and does eat. Some of us more than others. you know, it's like everybody's had that experience of food. So it's I don't know, it's my way in. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, you know, it makes me think about the word fusion and what that meant for cuisine for so long. And it was, you know, this mashup of two cultures with very little contextual basis. You know, it was more about flavor profiles rather than...
Or shock value.
Yeah, rather than kind of the story behind it. And right. When you talk about something as you know, distinctly different as Moorish cuisine, you know, almost, you know, the Jews, the Ashkenazis and Sephardics in you know, Spain, and the corollaries to Mexico, I understand that from a flavor profiles perspective, but then I know there's so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are things like the Portuguese, all the port foods around the world,
totally.
From Macau to the story of Maggie, M-A-G-G-I, the soy sauce that made its way all the way to Latin America.
Right.
And, you know, fusion doesn't have to just be a mashup. It can be a marriage. And, you know, I wonder if you explore that thing in the same way that you're a dual citizen. Mm-hmm. Do you look at the marriage between your parents, English and Israeli food, and see the similarities and differences?
You know, I think the only thing that kind of I could assign to my father is like a food culture of his own is like his love of Marmite and Twiglets and eating cheese and raisins and like, you know, he's basically a pescatarian. If he had his druthers, that's what he would be. Whereas my mother is so, she's like me. Like, this is the best way I can equate it is, I don't know if you've ever seen like a blind child, little child, and they'll like press things on their chin to understand it better because it's one of the surfaces that they can experience the world through. And it's not so far off. I don't go for the chin, but I go in the mouth and I want to experience things that way. So there's not a lot that I can recognize, in mashups in my parents. You know, my mom's basically the cook in the house. And she's an amazing one. So, there's very little there to observe. I think it's probably just through all the travel that I was fortunate enough to do growing up with my parents. And their curiosities of checking out other cultures and stuff like that, that, I don't know, it's been something that I've kind of arrived at, I think, on my own, not because I've watched my parents expose me to that, I guess.
Have you been to Israel?
I have.
It's kind of a fascinating time in New York seeing, like, a hamasarias open up here.
Yeah.
And I know before you said you have a larger affinity towards your home kitchen than you do going out to eat, but... What is it like seeing Israeli cuisine kind of start to find its place in this metropolis?
I think it's both rad and also like there's like the little kid in me that is like, no, mine, not for you. I think my concern is you know, someone who's Mexican might look at me and have the same feeling, but I get concerned that there will be kind of a reductive quality and the thought of like, oh, Israeli food, hummus, falafel, shawarma. And there's just so much more. I mean, it's a melting pot in Israel, you know, and it's so much more than I think I was aware of. It was just so natural to me growing up, and it makes so much more sense now that my mom is so curious about the world through food. It's because in Israel, for her growing up post-war, there was a melting pot. You had the Arab influence, you had the Ashkenazim, you had the Sephardim that were coming, you have, like, everybody from everywhere. And it's that's the world we live in. But in terms of my feelings, it's awesome that people are getting to know Israeli food. I hope that they like really get in there and like.
Well, what should we be exposed to outside of hummus and falafel and shawarma?
That's a good question. I mean, it's funny because while I do have citizenship there and I've spent a lot of time there, I'm often I go to visit family and I'm stuck in kitchens eating like my aunt's cheesecake, which is like the only cheesecake I'll eat. And, you know, having Nescafe and like answering the same 20 questions that I get from family on repeat. And so, I don't know, for me, it's still an exploration. I think the interesting thing, I mean, it's just the bounty in terms of the produce that comes out of Israel is amazing. And the approach of taking references and putting it together. So I would say just go to Israel.
Yeah. Or the Diamond District here in
New York. Or the Diamond District.
You know, yeah. I've
get yourself some diamonds.
Yeah, it's like one block on, 46th mm-hmm. Street. And you can kind of creep up and down second and third floor restaurants.
Yeah.
And, you know, get boreks, borekas
yeah.
everywhere. And it's one of the few, other than like Borough Park and East Williamsburg, yeah. where there is like a public and welcoming Jewish enclave of restaurants.
Yeah.
But is Jewish necessarily Israeli?
No. I mean, I think my friends at NY Shuk are doing an amazing job kind of championing all the different angles of Israeli cuisine. And they come from a Sephardic background. And so for me, when I go over there, I eat things that are familiar to me, and I don't necessarily know kind of the etymology of them, you know, where they came from, what the root was, and being able to trace, you know, whether on one side they have some Lebanese in the family, they have Moroccan in the family, and there's Turkish. And so I get to see all these different things. I mean, burekas come in like so many different cultures. I've been kind of obsessed with making phyllo by hand recently, but I come to that, for example, through refugees that my parents worked with when I was a kid who were Bosnian. And so they were just rolling, you know, I didn't know what it was specifically at the time. I was just like, wow, that dough is really thin and see-through and delicious. But it's, you know, it's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. So, again, I don't know if that answered your question.
No. See, the fact that you think it's all the same thing just better illustrates how much of a citizen of the world you are.
Thank you.
And how everyone should kind of think in that same vein. And the best way to do so is by looking at your Instagram, by working with and collaborating.
Yes.
And amen. Just sitting down for a conversation with you, because you are such a wealth of knowledge and, again, compassion to all these different, you know, cultures and cuisines, that it's always a refreshing, you know, conversation with you. And selfishly, that's why you're on air with me today, because it's been too long and we needed to catch
totally.
Up.
Totally. Thank you for having me. It's so much fun to be here.
What's your website?
It's very boring. It's Mira Evnin or miraevnin.com.
And your Instagram?
So boring, I couldn't remember it. It's also at Mira Evnin. You can also find me at Walnut X Vine.
And what is the Walnut X Vine extension?
That came out of having done a floral install, kind of a massive one, 2 years ago for Hermes. And it was a dear friend of mine that I had gone to school with who was working for me on the project that pushed me to do it. She was like, this is your chance. You need to start this other Instagram name. And so that there, it's a little bit more all things round the table. And kind of, I think, the more professional side of me in some ways. Some days I think it's more professional, and some days I just think it's another excuse to take pictures and post.
Well, food and flowers and everything in between on the table.
Yes.
Check out everything that Mira does. And thank you again for being on.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Tickell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Big thank you to Music by Cookies and David Tadashore Engineering. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.